Welcome to the Vine and River podcast. Here, authorities in the world of wine help us understand the intersection of wine and water. This podcast is authored by Russian Riverkeeper, a nonprofit organization dedicated to conservation and protection of clean, fishable, swimmable, and equitably shared Russian River, one of the largest water resources in Sonoma County, California. I am your host, Lenka Davis. Welcome to the sixth episode of Vine and River Podcast. In this episode, we will unusually give the microphone to our own executive director, Don McConnell, who together with staff attorney Jamie Neary has been commenting on an order which is directly linking vineyard farming activity and protection of water quality in North Coast Rivershed areas. The order name is General Waste Discharge Requirements for Commercial Vineyards in the North Coast Region, order number R1-2024-0056. Don, why is this order and its outcome important for Russian Riverkeeper?
Thank you, Lenka. One of the biggest issues facing the Russian River as far as water quality is sediment pollution. Between historic logging practices, poorly designed roads, and then construction sites, and then agriculture. When we break the soil, we generally increase erosion rates. So all the other sources of sediment have been addressed. Construction sites have a permit, industrial sites. The city of Santa Rosa and all our nine cities in the watershed have permits that regulate sediment discharge. So we have 65,000 acres of vineyards, and those have never been regulated for water quality. So there's been no accounting for the amount of sediment that ends up in the river. And it might seem counterintuitive, but when 1 acre of a vineyard loses a ton of soil, it's the thickness of a piece of paper. So it's really easy when we break up the soil to see tons of soil per acre wash into the Russian River.
What does excess sediment do to salmonids and other species? How about the effects on aquatic plants?
The principal impact is on aquatic organisms, salmon being the most important. When you have a lot of fine sediment coming in, especially during the winter months, in the early part of the winter, that's when salmon have laid their eggs and steelhead, and those eggs are buried under 3, 4, 5 inches of gravel. When you have a big pulse of fine sediment come in, as the water recedes and the creeks slowly recede from their flood peaks, that fine sediment will settle into those interstitial spaces in the rock and literally deprive fish eggs of oxygen, which they need. That's probably the most egregious impact because those are listed species we're spending tens of millions a year trying to save. When we look at microcrustaceans and what we call micro and macro invertebrates, the little microscopic bugs that live in the bed of the stream, that's your fish food. And when we have a lot of fine sediment come in, it can smother those organisms as well. So not only are we directly impacting salmon by potentially depriving their eggs of oxygen, we're also reducing their food supply. We don't see as big an impact on aquatic vegetation. I mean, sadly, most of our native aquatic submerged and floating plants have become extinct in the last 100 years. But it also creates problems with water supply. Here in the city of Hillsburg, where our office is based, there's 4 city wells we can't use during the middle of the winter because it's just too turbid. And that turbidity eventually works its way into our water supply, and we have to shut those wells down because of the high turbidity loads. The same issue occurs with individual residential wells and things like that. So it's not just a problem for the species and the organisms in the river. It's actually it increases the cost of water treatment and reduces water quality for people. The last issue is sediment has a certain ionic charge, and often it will bind with undesirable things, pollutants, phosphates, things like that. So we see other impacts as sediment is released and mobilized and discharged into the river. it brings other stuff with it. It brings hitchhikers that are also undesirable. So there's almost a secondary impact from sediment as well.
Such as agricultural pesticides, but we'll talk about this later. I am going to go back to turbidity and the NTU measurement, which in your comments to the proposed order, you have mentioned that you are praising the existence of the measurement of the turbidity and the limits at 250 NTU, but you're also saying this might be a little too generous, a little too high, and you're proposing 50 NTU. I would like you to explain why the measurement of the turbidity is important and why you're suggesting the levels that are five times lower in absolute numbers.
First, there's a number of ways you can measure the amount of sediment in the water body. One is total suspended solids, where you're literally taking a water sample, usually a liter of water. You pass it through an ultrafine filter that's like tenths of microns. It captures everything that's not H2O. And then you dry that filter out, you weigh it, and you get kind of a bulk reading of how much sediment is in the X many milligrams per liter of sediment. Turbidity is a measure of water clarity, and that's measured simply by shining a beam of light through a water column. When we use our tester, we essentially fill small bottles with sample water. We put them in the reader. It shoots a beam of light through that water. And depending on how much light is received on the other side of the sample, it gives you a measurement of water clarity. 250 NTU, that it's nephthalmic units. It's just, you know, like inches or yards or feet. When we look at the impacts of 250 NTU on salmon eggs, on biota, the other impact of sediment is it makes it harder for juvenile fish to find food because they can't see. It affects their sense of smell. If we went strictly based on scientific literature and we said, what does it take to truly protect salmon, that number would be at 50. North Coast Regional Water Quality Control Board, their staff set it higher at 250 based on both a lot of data that we've collected and shared with the staff, and also in recognition, the goal of the permit isn't zero sediment, it's to reduce sediment to some significant amount from where we are today. So that 250 NTU, what it is, it's a measuring stick for how effective your best management practices are in your vineyard to control erosion. And I do believe if we can get everyone under 250, that would be a dramatic reduction in the amount of sediment in the river every time it rains. So that's a good starting point. I think as we learn more and data is collected, we can see, is it feasible for vineyards to get to 50 NTU? It's difficult because the water board in the state essentially can't tell people how to farm, but they can tell them, here's your goal, and then suggest ways they can get there, best management practices or what have you. It's a little bit tough. They have to put out some measurable goal for them to achieve. And so 250 NTU is certainly better than 500. You know, we'd love to see it lower because that would be much more productive. But thinking of, say, the construction industry and industrial sites, they're not at 50. So there's a need to be fair and make sure we're holding various industries to a similar standard.
To take this to practical terms, what does it take for a vineyard owner to take that turbidity measurement from 250 to 50? What kind of practices can really make an impact?
We know a little bit. We don't have all the answers. Russian River Keeper spent 4 years sampling runoff from vineyards where the runoff was representing just the vineyard. It wasn't mixed with other land uses. There wasn't run on to that vineyard. It was runoff that was unique to that vineyard. At the same time, we were taking pictures of their field treatments. What does their vineyard look like? What are they doing? What kind of measures are they putting in place to control sediment? We also took pictures of a lot of these same vineyards in the dry season, so we could see how are you managing your soil in the middle of summer, and then what's it look like as we're sampling in the winter, and then often we go back towards the end of the rainy season, and essentially we learned several really important things from all that data. And we collected about 300 plus samples, and from probably at least 150-ish vineyard properties. So we got a pretty wide sample set. What we found is vineyards that broke the soil, that were cultivating the soil, that were coming through with discs, with plows, with what have you, to turn over their cover crop or whatever their reason was, always correlated to extremely high sediment measurements. The other thing we saw was when you cultivate your soil in the summer and then you add seed to your vineyard and then either use your overhead sprinklers to start that germinating, those seeds to germinate, or you just let the natural fall rains germinate it. Oftentimes, you know, you've got this tiny wisp of grass with no roots, and roots are one of the principal means of holding soil together and cohesing it. So what we learned is if you break your soil and you till and you sow annual cover crop, usually there's a period between when your harvest is, when you're usually putting your vineyard to bed, and when we have some of our biggest rainstorms in December and January, when there's just really no, practically no cover crop to cover your soil. The other insight we found is a lot of vineyards have been transitioning to what we call permanent cover crop. In the warm months, once the rain season's over, they'll mow, they'll crimp, they'll do a number of things to manage the weeds, but they won't till them under. So that what happens in the fall is in that first rain or when they turn on their overhead sprinklers after harvest, not only do you have root structures still preserved under the soil holding the soil together, you've also got some amount of stubble on the surface that protects the soil from raindrop erosion. When a raindrop hits the soil, it's like a mini explosion. But also, when you look at alternative row tilling that a lot of people do, we've looked extensively at those vineyards, and in the rows they don't till in that given year, that grass is springing back to life, and there's nothing but clear water coming off of that row, and the row next to it that was tilled and annually seeded has a bunch of muddy water in it. So disturbing the soil is one of the most key factors. That said, we found some real anomalies. There are a couple vineyard folks who are dry farmers. They don't use any irrigation. And some of those vineyards are cross-ripped down to 3 feet deep. I mean, you talk about breaking up soil cohesion, but those same farmers have things they do. When they cross-rip the fields, they bring in tons of compost per acre, specialized compost. A lot of them make it themselves. And they add seeds so that the field, as you break the surface of the soil, you reduce organic matter, which helps keep your soil from eroding. They're replacing the organic matter. They're depleting through tilling. And some of the best water quality results, I mean, we're talking less than 20 NTU, came out of dry farm vineyards that were deep ripped every summer. And Paul Bérinier is a good example. He both at his own vineyard and at vineyards he manages, he uses this practice, and we have looked at every property he farms, and somehow it's working. We're not quite sure what's going on, but that's a good example of if you give a farmer a goal and tell him, go out and figure it out. You're a farmer, you know your vineyard, you know your soil. That's a good example of letting someone be creative and them actually arriving at your solution, actually beating, I mean, 20 NTUs way under 250. So we don't want to prescribe farming methods. That's a good example of why prescribing methods isn't a great approach.
I think that we can't just look at it from the position of turbidity. We have to see the whole picture and the cost on carbon footprint or mycorrhizal fungi is really high. even though the turbidity may be low.
That's going beyond the water quality focus, but I think in thinking of the concept of sustainability, thinking about how many times you're driving a tractor in your field should be part of your calculus for sustainability. With Paul Bérinier's operation, he literally went into the field once a year with his tractor. Other than that, he'd come in with some equipment to harvest, but that was his one intervention. And then I see some of the fields that are cultivated annually, I see those tractors working the rows 3 and 4 times a year. He takes decomposed hay and rotting hay and horse manure and vegetable crop residues, and he really puts some work into composting it.
In the requirement for the ground cover for a winterization period, there is some discussion about how much of the ground cover has to be covered by the rooted cover crop. Can you speak to this discussion?
In the back and forth with the industry, with the regulators, there's been an interest in creating incentives. The industry has been complaining about the cost of the permit and the cost per acre, especially on smaller farmers who, say, have a 40 or 60 acre vineyard and that's all they got. In that discussion, we looked at what are the things that are proven to lead to good water quality outcomes. And if people would do that on their own, without being told to do it, then there's some flexibility in the permitting. If you have 90% planted or rooted cover crop during the winterization period, then you don't have to do the water quality monitoring. And so that's an incentive that saves time, money. So our goal there was to drive people to these practices. Unfortunately, at the hearing, the Wine Institute and a number of other large vineyard companies in our watershed asked that we change the winterization period from December 15th to April 15th, change it from that to February 15th through April 15th. Well, last time I checked my own records and National Weather Service records, it starts raining here in September, October, and we really start getting significant rains in November and early December. So the thought of changing and shrinking the winterization period to cover maybe a third or less of the entire rain season when you're trying to protect water quality makes absolutely no sense. It's ludicrous. Why bother having a regulation? You've just made it completely meaningless. So the reason they were asking that is they said, oh my gosh, it's hard for us to get our annual cover when they till, break their soil, they turn their vineyard to bare dirt, and then they have to rush and plant stuff and try and get it up and holding the soil. In our experience, you rarely are anywhere as close to 90% coverage, and they have graphics that show you what that means on the ground by December 15th. You know, in our opinion, the only way you can achieve that standard is to not break the soil and to have permanent cover crop. They do have options at lower percent cover, 50 and 70, and those are definitely an improvement over some vineyards as they currently exist today. But still, we know that 50% bare dirt is never going to get you under 250 NTU. So that's not really a great solution.
Perhaps we should talk about why some vineyard owners might be more prone to thinking that clearing their ground of any vegetation but the vines and eliminating any competition might be a good practice in terms of vineyard economics. But we do have some studies that show that after first 3 years of farming with cover crops, it might actually not be more expensive to incorporate those cover crops.
I really am not qualified to speak to why a farmer would do it. I hear them give their reasons that, oh, we're sealing the soil to hold in more moisture. But wait a minute, all the science, literally science going back to 1930, has told us when you break the soil, you reduce organic matter. The percent of organic matter determines how much water your soil holds. So you're saying, oh, I don't want the soil to wick the water up and it'll evaporate on the ground or the weeds will soak it up. That's a double-edged sword. Yeah, you'll be gaining on one side and losing on another side. So you're not, you know, you're just, when you cultivate the soil, you're going to increase the irrigation demands of a plant. That seems like you're not really making any progress there.
When you increase the ground cover, you are increasing the water recharge. You also, if you use it as a green mulch, if you're crimping your material, it keeps the ground cooler, so there's less evaporation, and then it creates the layer that prevents the evaporation. So if you know how to use it well, you might preserve more water.
When I think about how soil management is done here, and I think about climate change, I think climate change will drive more people to permanent cover crop. Because what the other thing I've heard from vineyard people is when I have bare soil under my vines, and all of a sudden the temperature spikes to 115 degrees, which it unfortunately has been doing more and more frequently, the air temps in those vineyards are a lot hotter with bare ground than with some, you know, dead stubble cover crop from the winter before. So that plus, you're exactly right. If you have permanent cover crop and you have high organic content in your soil because you're not constantly breaking it and it's over time building organic material in the soil, one, your vineyard will not just hold more water per foot of soil, but it will accept more water. It will wick more water into your groundwater underneath your vineyard, which is a monstrous benefit in a drought. What we've seen in vineyards that repeatedly till, I mean, there's a couple of vineyards that we've been watching very closely because they're next to some projects we're working on. They work that soil 3 to 4 times a season. And what we see in the winter is water standing on the surface of soil for weeks after heavy rain. It's not sinking into the ground. And that's because they're creating an impervious hardpan layer at some level below ground. Because of that tilling, it compacts the soil and it accumulates fines. Because every time it rains, it drives the finest material downward. Then you end up with this very impervious layer not far below the soil surface. So when we go out and we were looking at vineyards for 4 years, we rarely saw runoff volumes coming out of permanent cover crop vineyards that were anywhere close the volume of runoff from cultivated vineyards. They lose more water. So when it rains 2 inches, some of that water is running off that cultivated field where 100% of it is going into the soil, going into the local groundwater aquifer for the permanent cover crops. And that's why I think prolonged droughts that we expect more and more of, years where we get 50% of rainfall like 2020, 2021, the changes in the Eel River diversion that's going to leave less water in the upper basin, I would think that would be a bigger incentive than maybe this permit to get people to rethink how they're farming. I mean, we have case studies with experts like Mark Greenspan, who you've interviewed, that showed if we stop cultivating the soil, you know, we can boost organic matter within a year or two to the point where you're replacing your entire irrigation volume by soil moisture storage. So the water's loaded into your soil. The vine just needs to go get it and access it.
Another related subject that you mentioned in your comments to this proposed order is the vegetative buffering streamside. There is a certain distance that a vineyard row or agricultural row should be from a streamside to prevent the runoff. What is this distance and how is this distance substantiated?
One of the goals of what we call a grassy or a vegetated buffer strip is if you have erosion occurring in your field, it would somehow magically be filtered by these vegetated buffers. We don't ever see that in practice. If you have muddy, very highly turbid water moving across a field and it passes through 30 feet of grass, we don't see clean water coming out on the other end. Generally passes through. Grass is not a filter. Grass keeps soil from eroding in the first place. The goal there was to back the vineyard up from the edge of the river, which also has benefits in reducing the amount of Pierce's disease you might have in your vineyard, because you basically put your vines right where some vineyard pests happen to live naturally, and these are native sharpshooters. But the goal of that was also to address the whole temperature issue. Our Russian River and most North Coast rivers are impaired for temperature. They're not, you know, basically we've denuded the riverbanks. We've changed groundwater seepage, reduced that by the proliferation of pumps. And so part of that goal was to reduce the level of activity right next to the stream so that vegetative canopy can be better and not be impacted by farming activities, so that it would shade the stream and reduce solar radiation. So, you know, that distance is really important. In the hearing that was held last week, there was a lot of back and forth about where we measure that. And the most telling thing to me was a retired fish and wildlife biologist from the State Department of Fish and Wildlife, who was an expert in what we need to do to make our creeks healthier again, basically said, you're basically going to legalize how things are today, and how things are today is pretty broken. So unfortunately, I don't know if the permit's going to make a lot of headway there. You know, it's interesting because we look at Napa Valley, and people are taking vineyards out of production along the borders of streams to create more of a barrier between what they're doing in their vineyard and what's happening in that stream. So I'm kind of hopeful, because we often see cutting edge and emerging practices happening in Napa before we do in Sonoma, quite frankly. And that's a place where they're running way ahead of our North Coast area and the Russian River and the Navarro River and Gualla River, where we're still farming right up to the edge of a stream, it seems. Ultimately, I think bigger floods might get some people questioning if they're a little too close to the danger point there. Climate change is going to be a powerful motivator for people to revisit their practices. And I think the encroachment on stream corridors is one of those areas where I think future floods are going to chase people away from the edge of the stream.
Let's touch on another issue, which is pesticide runoff. What's the current requirement for pesticide residue testing, and what is Russian Riverkeeper recommending for this order to state?
We have done a fair amount of sampling for pesticides. In fact, we've done some of the biggest pesticide testing programs in the Russian River watershed. And what we learned was most of the pesticides in our waterways are coming from residential applications in urban areas. We, I think, once or twice found simazine, which is a synthetic herbicide, in the river. We're not typically seeing a high pesticide loading in runoff when the rain hits the ground and washes the fields. There is a focus in the permit on pesticide testing, and it's not really influenced by problems in the Russian River. It's influenced by problems in the East San Joaquin Valley, which has nothing to do with the Russian River. So the State Water Board, which oversees the 9 regional water quality control boards, they are always pushing to have state standards. And if anyone knows, farmers know our state better than anyone, we have an incredibly diverse state. And when you go down to the East San Joaquin, they get, you know, 4 to 6 inches of rain per year, and they're pumping the groundwater to death. Here, we get 35 inches of rain per year, and we're not necessarily needing to pump our groundwater to death. So essentially, what's going on in the East San Joaquin is you've been applying very powerful synthetic fertilizers and pesticides for 100 years. And because there's so little rainfall and you're pulling moisture downward because of all this groundwater pumping, they have thousands of wells for domestic consumption for people that are polluted with a number of pesticides. all the well data we've looked at in the Russian River, we're not seeing pesticides as a major, major issue. But what the permit requires is more of a focus on testing if there's a residential or a well-serving people in or near your vineyard. The vineyard is responsible to test that for nitrate, which is a fertilizer, which is often a problem and a real problem for humans if it gets too high. And then a certain amount of pesticides that are commonly used in vineyards in Sonoma County. What we see in the vineyards as far as surface water runoff, if you don't have a lot of dirt leaving your vineyard, anything you're putting in your vineyard is probably staying in your vineyard. And that's success. So we look at sediment being a proxy for everything else, for fertilizers, for herbicides, for pesticides, for sulfur, for copper sulfate. I mean, even organic vineyards are using fungicides. I mean, if it has any amount of copper in it, it is a real problem. From our perspective, if we can just reduce the sediment, then we're winning on all those other things. And then there is, because it's a statewide precedential requirement handed down by the State Water Board in Sacramento, there is a need to do some amount of groundwater testing where you have residential wells that could be under the influence of your vineyard operations. Our goal is to see that just focusing on where there might be a problem. And if they do a certain amount of testing and they don't find problems, we think that it's reasonable to say, put your money somewhere else, like keeping your sediment in your field and out of the river.
When are you expecting to hear about the final wording and outcome of this order?
The tentative word from the North Coast Water Board is they're going to bring it back for a final decision in February. We'll see. I mean, they're, like a lot of regulatory agencies, they're overworked and understaffed, so that might slide into March. But we do see that coming back early this spring and potentially getting adopted.
Where can a farmer, a vineyard owner, a household owner find out more about the order or about the results of it?
The North Coast Water Quality Control Board, or the North Coast Water Board, if you Google that and the word vineyard, you'll be staring at the page for the vineyard order. The other thing, if people are interested in learning how to take better care of their soil, we're in a great place for that. I mean, there is our resource conservation districts. We have a bevy of consultants. We have all these people teaching permaculture classes. I was talking to Ridgely Evers from Devero Vineyards. They're actually moving their winery production off their farm so they can turn their winery into a classroom and start trying to teach the younger viticulturalists how they can farm in a profitable manner with permanent cover crop and do these things that both set up the industry for success in climate change and to protect our environment. If we can reduce water use, pesticide use, all those things, that's good for the farmer, not as much cost. It's good for the people working in the vineyards, and it's good for the community. Luckily, there's a lot of resources. If people want to really get it right, we have the resources to help people do that in this area.
That's very encouraging and inspiring. Thank you so much for taking time today to talk to me about this huge subject for everyone here who is farming and also everyone who is enjoying the clarity, the drinkability, the fishability, all the things we have in our mission statement of the Russian River.
You're welcome, and I look forward to listening to your next podcast as they keep coming out.
If you enjoyed today's episode, please consider donating to Russian River Keeper, a nonprofit organization dedicated to conservation and protection of clean, fishable, swimmable, and equitably shared Russian River. Go to RussianRiverKeeper.org to learn more or to contribute today.